106.
I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. The Libertarian candidate who ran for president in 2012, Gary Johnson, received just 1 million votes. It's not easy to be a third-party candidate under the current political system. Our guest Robert Draper says that the public's frustration with government surveillance and costly wars, plus the growing support for gay marriage and legalized marijuana, could mean that the time is right for libertarian ideas. His recent New York Times Magazine cover story, "Has the Libertarian Moment Finally Arrived?" focuses largely on younger voters and the appeal of Rand Paul, who has libertarian leanings, kind of like his dad, Ron. Today we continue our Ballot Talk series, spending this hour on Thursdays on Radio Times talking politics, and we ask Robert Draper to join us. He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, wrote a book about the Tea Party, now out in paperback, called When the Tea Party Came to Town. And Robert Draper, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thanks so much for having me, Marty.
So what does it mean to call oneself a libertarian in the year 2014?
Well, that's a question that's answered different ways by different people, but I suppose the most general way of answering it is that libertarianism or libertarian thought presupposes a bias towards liberty and concomitantly then a bias towards a restrained government. And so what that means in practice is that any issue that comes up, the solution should be viewed in the belief of libertarians as having a bias in favor of the individual or in the government that is closest to the individual, be it the individual, then the family, and then the community, and then beyond that the state, and then as a last resort the federal government.
And why do you think that's an appealing idea today?
Well, there are a few things going on out there, Marty. Start with the fact that there is a general public whose identification with either major party is at historic lows. And one of those political parties, the Republican Party, is in the midst of a full-blown identity crisis born out of losing the popular vote in 5 of the last 6 elections and recognizing that its core demographic group, middle-aged white men, is fast shrinking. In the meantime, there is a Republican candidate, Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who's offering up a new version of what a Republican identity could look like, and that identity is one that's distinctively libertarian-leaning. Where will he get his votes from? There is a generation of young voters who've been thoroughly turned off by Republicans in recent years, but who also aren't comfortable these days identifying themselves as Democrats, and who align with Rand Paul on a number of issues that could be termed libertarian. Now, does all of that constitute a libertarian moment? Maybe yes, maybe no. But does all that constitute a pretty good moment to ponder libertarians? I thought so, and that's what the magazine piece sought to do.
And the title ends with a question mark. It's not.
Yes.
This is not a statement. It is a question. One of, I guess, the raps on libertarianism or even the Libertarian Party is that it's a party that privileged young white men are attracted to. Do you think there's some truth to that?
I do, yes. And in fact, I think that it would certainly be a problem for the Republican Party incorporating libertarianism insofar as among the constituent groups that has been most reliably Democratic in recent years has been single women. And single women, according to polls, have a faith in government, look to government for solutions in ways that are disproportionate beyond other constituent groups. Libertarianism, with its bias against government, with its belief that whenever possible government should be stripped down, it seems uniquely equipped to repel single women. For that matter, for minorities, historically, libertarianism has been about laissez-faire, which includes, in the case of, say, racial discrimination, not federal intervention. Now, I've talked to a lot of libertarians about what would you guys have done at the time of, say, the 1964 Civil Rights Act, at the time of the freedom marches, et cetera. And their view is actually, the ones that I talked to, was that federal intervention was warranted because state government had essentially sanctioned discrimination. And so there really was no other recourse. This was not just a matter of sit back and let the market take care of itself, but you get mixed opinions on that subject.
Wasn't Rand Paul asked that question about the lunch counters and back in the 1960s and what he would have done?
Yes, and his response was, I think, unsatisfactory to all sides. This was during his 2010 campaign for Senate, and he was asked whether he would support the Civil Rights Act, and he said that while he was certainly against discrimination, he was viscerally uncomfortable at the notion of private businesses being told who they could cater to and who they could not. This caused a great backlash, and ever since then, Senator Paul has been doing his level best to make it clear that he never said he was against the 1964 Civil Rights Act, and now, in fact, is steadfastly an advocate of it.
And I do want to pick up on that, but let me go back to some of the issues that you think are appealing to young voters. One is taking a hard and critical look at the war on drugs, legalizing marijuana, concerns about things like government surveillance, support for gay marriage, reducing the prison population, reducing the military budget. You see those as largely libertarian ideas?
Yes and no. I mean, some of those line up very clearly with classic liberal thinking. Some of those with classic Republican thinking. And so the Pew Research Center, in fact, came out with a survey just about 6 or 7 weeks ago. And it was a study of voters, and it found that in addition to the usual ideological groups of solid liberals, business conservatives, faith-based conservatives, etc., two very distinctive groups of young voters stuck out. One of them they called young outsiders, who tend to be fiscally conservative but socially not so, and the other what they called next generation left, who tend to be traditional liberals on social issues but less so on things like the social safety net. And the point that Pew was making with their findings was that neither of these groups aligns well with the GOP or with the Democrats, and so you cannot call them steadfast Democrats or Republicans, and for that matter, these voters themselves do not wed themselves to it. Now, that more often than not, they have voted Republican, or I'm sorry, Democrat, but that's largely because the Republicans have essentially taken themselves out of the game with strident stances on social issues and with things like the Bush Wars. But they are nonetheless, certainly pollsters view them as being up for grabs.
As you know, you got some pushback on this article, David, from Jonathan Chait. And I'll just quote something that David Frum wrote in The Atlantic. Spoiler alert, Draper is wrong, emphatically wrong. Young voters are not libertarian, not even trending libertarian. He goes on to say that basically voters under 30 are pro-government. And in fact, he says the most pro-government age group since that cohort has been since the Great Depression. Can you speak to that?
Sure, yeah, and let's stipulate that while I have a lot of respect for David as well as for John Chait, that progressives and conservatives don't have a lot in common. They have one thing in common, and that is a disdain of libertarians. And so a story that would dare to even suggest the proposition that it might be a libertarian moment, I was never expecting any of them to say, you know what,
You're wrong.
All wrong. Yeah. So, but as to what Frum is saying specifically, I mean, where he's correct is that it is a mixed bag. There's no question that millennials support Obamacare. They believe that government has a role to play in their lives, but not when addressing income inequality, and for that matter, by a 2-to-1 margin, the millennials that were polled think that government agencies abuse their powers rather than try to do the right thing. And that includes, but is not by any means limited to, the NSA's domestic surveillance activity. Now, is that a classically liberal impulse? Supporting lower penalties for drug use, supporting gay marriage, yes, but not this sort of visceral aversion to having faith in government. They want a role in government in their lives, but they're still very suspicious of it.
But why not? And this is to the Libertarian Party. Does that mean that the time might be right for a Libertarian candidate to get more than 1 million votes, as Gary Johnson did in 2012?
I certainly don't think so, no. And in fact, though this was left out of the story, the conclusion of the story was going to be that I attended the Libertarian Party's national convention in Columbus, Ohio this summer and sat with the New Jersey delegation and asked all of them, so would you guys get behind a Rand Paul candidacy? They looked at me like I was nuts, and they said, no, you mean instead of supporting our own candidate? Since 1971, when the Libertarian Party was first stood up, they have never gotten more than one electoral vote, and it does not even seem to be the LP's goal to ever gain enough to win. Their point, their raison d'etre, in their view, is to advance libertarian ideas. It's important, Marty, listeners to understand that these millennial voters who may embrace views that you could say are libertarian are not saying we are libertarians, much less saying we are going to vote in droves for the Libertarian Party candidate. I do not see that happening.
Well, you did quote a number of libertarians in your piece, including Nick Gillespie, and here's a quote that he gave you. He says, the whole point of America is that it's in constant state of becoming, constantly changing and mongrelizing. We're doing exactly what free minds and free markets allow you to do. Part of why I'm a libertarian is that if you restrict people less, interesting stuff happens. I underlined that because I thought, okay, take that and translate that into a policy for me. I mean, it's right. An interesting intellectual, philosophical idea that you could have around a dinner party table, but how do you translate that into politics?
I have to say, Marty, that was one of the most frustrating, borderline infuriating parts of researching this story. The libertarians are certainly an interesting group of people to hang out with, but when you try to nail them down on specific policies, they become very discursive and somewhat entangled in their own logic and very much contradicting each other. There are certain baseline things like foreign policy, where generally speaking, they tend to be, if not isolationist, then very restrictionist. And there's large agreement amongst libertarians on, whether or not to invade Libya, Syria, Nigeria, etc. The answer is no. But when it comes to other issues like immigration, they're all over the map. On abortion, even, which for many, many years, pro-choice was sort of the view that was endemic to the libertarian movement. That changed in 1988 when their presidential candidate, the Libertarian Party's presidential candidate, Ron Paul, said no. In fact, the bedrock libertarian principle, the non-aggression principle, should be applied to the most defenseless, and that's the unborn. And so there's widespread disagreement, and where the rubber meets the road vis-a-vis libertarianism is definitely an open question.
Well, and that really contradicts something that Ayn Rand said about abortion. She said an embryo has no rights. Abortion is a moral right.
That's right. Yes, and of course, now she said that in 1968. That was pre Roe v. Wade, and I'm sure that was a big applause line back then. And now I think that it's that particular subject. It's a subject, let's be honest, that a lot of Americans, not just libertarians, are uncomfortable with, but is one that provokes a lot of sort of hand wringing amongst libertarians. But that's even the case with drug policy. I mean, every libertarian I talk to supports decriminalization of and maybe outright legalization of marijuana. They become a great deal more subdued when the subject turns to cocaine or heroin. And on immigration, there are people who espouse open borders, but they're not literalists about it. And so then you get entangled in who polices the borders, and just the very word of police, makes
police.
Libertarians very nervous. Yes, and so there's the Libertarian Party puts out a platform every year, but amongst these sort of libertarian thought leaders, there's a great deal of disagreement as to what they would want libertarianism to look like.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation, talking with Robert Draper about a cover story he had in the New York Times earlier this month. Question, has the libertarian moment arrived? It was in the August 7th issue of the magazine. And this is our Ballot Talks series that we're running every Thursday at this time on Radio Times, and we want to hear from you. What do you think of libertarianism or even the Libertarian Party? Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this short break. We'll be right back.
Does your son or daughter come home drunk or high? Would you like to learn new ways of dealing with their drug or alcohol use? The Family Training Program works with parents of children aged 12 to 25 to help them maintain control of their child's drug or alcohol problem. Held in Philadelphia by the Treatment Research Institute, a supporter of WHYY. More on the Family Training Program at 877-I-WORRY-2. That's 877-I-WORRY and the number 2. Or online at IamConcerned.org.
Hi, I'm Terry O'Reilly. Writer Maria Mills joins me to talk about her intimate conversations with the reclusive author Harper Lee, as well as the controversial memoir that came of them. Maria Mills on Harper Lee, coming up on Cue the Summer from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
They will blow up.
Fix up, soldier up, and learn what it means to be Army strong.
A promotional video from the U.S. Army, which is downsizing but still recruiting. We'll speak to a general in charge of bringing in new soldiers next time on Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. In fact, it's the Ballot Talk series on Radio Times, and Robert Draper is our guest. He's the author of a recent cover story in the New York Times Magazine, Has a Libertarian Moment Finally Arrived? And he's a contributing writer to the magazine. Wrote a book a couple of years ago about the Tea Party, out in paperback now, called When the Tea Party Came to Town. And at some point, Robert, I do want to sort of compare and contrast the Tea Party with the Libertarian Party. We have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. We also have a Facebook comment on the Radio Times Facebook from John. He says, I agree with some libertarian ideas, but I will never vote for any libertarian who runs on the Republican ticket. And it's interesting to take that and to think about Rand Paul, and I guess Ron Paul as well, both of them with libertarian leanings running on the Republican Party ticket. What do you make of that?
Well, I understand what the person who wrote in is saying, and I do not think that even a Rand Paul candidacy for president, and even should Senator Paul absolutely embrace, same-sex marriage, which he has yet to do, embrace decriminalization of marijuana when instead he's called for drastically reduced penalties. Even if he does this sort of thing, that is not to suggest that young voters in droves are going to move Republican. They've been suspicious of Republicans for years, believe them to be the party of intolerance. But to the extent that the Republican Party can grow its base, I think that the question of how they do so, which candidate gives them the best chance to do so, is probably answered by Rand Paul. He's a new politician. This is his first term as senator, and we'll see how the guy performs on the stump, and we'll see how he performs in the marathon that is a presidential campaign. But at least thus far, he seems to be the one Republican who most closely mirrors what young voters are interested in.
Do you think the Democratic Party has appeal for people who have these libertarian tendencies?
Up to a point. I mean, it's there is actually one congressman who's Democratic, Jared Polis, from Colorado, from Boulder, who I think comes closest to being a libertarian in his not only socially tolerant stances, but also his embrace of Bitcoin, his advocacy of pulling back on NSA powers. But even Congressman Polis said to me, "Look, you know, I favor Obamacare. I'm against the isolationism that a lot of libertarians espouse." And it's been a long time since the Democratic Party has been a hospitable place for libertarians who view themselves as being, you know, anti-big government. I think the last we saw a kind of wedding between Democrats and libertarians was in the early 1970s during the Nixon administration, when his was called the imperial presidency, when the Vietnam War was going on, when there was a war on drugs as well. Libertarians then sort of played ball with Democrats. They haven't since then, and in particular since Ronald Reagan declared that government is the problem, not the solution. That sounded like it was really ringing the chimes of libertarians, and they've sort of those have been the bedfellows ever since.
Would you say Ron Paul is a more pure libertarian than his son Rand?
Without question. I mean, anybody who says, as Congressman Ron Paul did, that he not only would never have gone into Iraq either of those times, he also said that President Abraham Lincoln was imprudent to declare war on the South. And he's been very frontal in his desire that the Fed be abolished. Rand Paul, his son, is a great deal more crafty and a great deal more cautious and, frankly, a great deal more ambitious, more desirous of being elected. And so you can see Rand Paul, more than anything else, trying to be the bridge between libertarian thinking types and the Republican Party. Ron Paul never attempted to be that bridge.
But do you think once someone runs sort of within the party structure, they end up being a Republican or a Democrat. And as you write and others have said, for Rand Paul, he has moderated on a number of more libertarian issues as he has been asked to explain his position on a whole host of important issues.
Sure. The one of the big cases in point is that it is anathema in the Republican Party to not be standing beside Israel and to voice anything that might sound like, if not outright support for the Palestinians, then at least a concern that the Israeli government has overstepped vis-a-vis the Palestinians. And so Rand Paul recently had something called the Stand with Israel Act, which basically would cut off all aid to Palestine unless the Palestinian government formally recognized Israel as a state, something they've never done, something they never will. Well, they might, but they're certainly not going to do it just because Rand Paul offers legislation to that. It was viewed by some libertarians I talked to as complete pandering on Senator Paul's part, and clearly an offering up to the more military hawkish aspect of the Republican Party.
He said some interesting things, though, about what's going on in Ferguson, Missouri, and talking about the militarization of the police. I mean, he's interesting in that you kind of can't peg him into a certain political hole.
No, and I thought, Marty, that was a really interesting gambit on Senator Paul's part. I mean, we have heard lots of people, to use the tired phrase, rush to judgment on what took place in the tragedy in Ferguson. But what Rand Paul said, and said very quickly after Michael Brown's shooting death, was that, look, this spectacle of the local police in Ferguson, Missouri, looking basically like an artillery unit, is unseemly and inappropriate. And it amounts to a militarized police, and we should do something about that. That is a very, very libertarian stance, and I think that it was something that people on all sides of the political spectrum said, you know, he's got a point on. So it's in that manner that Paul can be a really fresh voice, and to the degree that it's fresh, it's because it's libertarian.
And just a quote from him, he says, when you couple this militarization of law enforcement with an erosion of civil liberties and due process that allows the police to become judge and jury, national security letters, no-knock searches, broad general warrants, pre-conviction forfeiture, we begin to have a serious problem on our hands. And I can imagine, though, people from across a lot of political spectrums saying, yes, you're right.
Well, you know, classically, the Republican Party, at least since the days of Richard Nixon, has been the party of law and order. And the reflex has always been to say, we'll do whatever it takes to keep the streets quiet, to quash, you know, the sort of civil disobedience, unrest, etc. And so for a self-described Republican, albeit a Republican libertarian, he actually calls himself libertarian-ish, for Senator Paul to come out and say, you know, this is a wildly inappropriate thing. Incorporating the tonalities of police brutality that we used to hear from liberal groups throughout the 60s and 1970s is a very, very striking thing. But I think also something that will resonate, as you say, Marty, across the board. It's not just there are surely a lot of conservatives in America who just simply disapprove of seeing acting out their outrage in the streets. But there are at least as many, I think, who view the spectacle of a heavily, heavily armed police force with all the tear gas and say, this is not the way things should be in America.
Let me reintroduce you, and I do want to get some callers in on our conversation, talking about Robert Draper, author of a piece most recently in the New York Times Magazine, asking the question, has the libertarian moment finally arrived? He's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. He's written a number of books, including one now out in paperback called When the Tea Party Came to Town. And we want to hear from you about what you think about libertarianism, libertarian ideas, even candidates like Rand Paul. Give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. And again, this is Ballot Talks, our Thursday series on Radio Times. Let me get Kevin from Cherry Hill to join us. Hi, Kevin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
I just kind of have a comment, I guess. I'm 23 years old. I'm a recent college graduate. And I think the reason that libertarian appeals to young people is, I guess from what I can see, we're very just disenfranchised with the entire political system. And I'll be honest, I did vote for Gary Johnson in the most recent election. And essentially it was just hearing from someone all the things that someone like me wanted to hear from a candidate and someone who wasn't necessarily part of the system that has already been in place was really appealing in a candidate.
Kevin, before we hear from Robert Draper, what particular issues are you looking for, you care about?
Personally, legalization of marijuana is important, and a smaller foreign policy, I guess, less intervention in the world, and reform of tax code also.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and Robert Draper, that sounds like some of the people that you interviewed for your piece.
Sure, and again, one of the criticisms leveled by both sides of libertarians is that they're mainly like college students. They love the consistency of libertarianism. They love the fact that libertarians will legalize weed, but then they'll grow up, they'll start a family, and they'll become either Republicans or Democrats. That may well be the case, but what does seem to be the case is that millennials are not lining up neatly with either camp. And what Kevin was saying there, for example, a scaled back role in the world abroad, not just limiting itself to where and how we intervene, but also in foreign aid too, which is something that millennials that are polled oppose, and that is certainly not a progressive impulse. Mm-hmm. The reform of the tax code as well, the basic feeling that the economy is sort of rigged against them, and that's a visceral response that's captured in polls and does not see as its immediate solution, well, let's have more government. And so I think that's what I'm recognizing from Kevin's sentiments.
But foreign aid is a tiny, tiny portion of the money that we spend abroad.
Sure. No, that's right. And it's, that particularly has been a talking point among Republicans, or conservative groups to rail out against foreign aid when you're absolutely right, Marty. It constitutes just a sliver at best. But to hear people who might be inclined, millennial voters, are typically inclined to vote for Democrats, saying that they oppose foreign aid is a kind of new thing.
But are you also saying, though, because looking at the last two presidential elections, millennials in many ways went for President Obama, are you also saying that there's something the president has done to turn off people like Kevin?
Well, I think that the president has not been – well, first, let's point out that so much in the way of hope was invested in President Obama. I think that particularly in the 2008 election, voters, young voters, voted for him, really, really believing in the man. Since that time, he's given them less reason to believe. He has not been at the forefront of, say, decriminalization of marijuana. He has not, for that matter, been in the forefront of same-sex marriage. He led from behind, essentially, and Vice President Biden more or less brought him to that. His the NSA thing, I think, the domestic spying, has been very alarming for young Americans who might have expected that sort of thing from the Bush administration, but believed that that Obama would really be a civil libertarian, and so I think they've recoiled from that as well. In addition to now the knotty issues of Syria and Iran, and the suggestions that we may be involved there too, I think right. That turns off millennials as well.
And I was thinking, even preparing the show today, what would a libertarian do about ISIS? And I'm not saying I know what the answer to that question is, but.
Well, that's actually, a question I asked a lot of libertarians. Look, isn't it easy to sort of sit back and say, we don't have a role and should not have a role in these things. But if you were sitting in the Oval Office and, ISIS is most recently beheading a journalist, but also, creating the kind of bloodshed that they are, would you destabilizing the Iraqi government as a result of it, would you really just sit back with your arms folded? Typically, the libertarian response is, look, we have seen, empirically in recent years how our intervention not only has not solved the problem, but it's actually exacerbated it. We'll watch, through the presidential primary process. We'll see if Rand Paul continues to stick to that position. And it's clear you can already see battle lines, as it were, being drawn between, say, Governor Rick Perry of Texas, Marco Rubio, who's a great deal more of a hawk, and Rand Paul. And there is no question but that, well, they have already attacked him as an isolationist, the dreaded I word being used on libertarians. And they will surely do so. And we'll see if Paul sticks to his stances or if we see him kind of moving a little bit more towards the right in terms of the need to do something about ISIS, for example.
Let me get John from West Philadelphia to join us. Hi, John. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I'm one of those, I'm towards the older range of the millennial group, although I don't like that term. I've been involved in political process for a while now, and I'd like to comment on the young people leaning libertarian. I believe it's not so much because they agree with the libertarian viewpoint. It's because, for the most part, they're just uninformed. And being one of those younger people, I have to say that for every campaign I've ever worked on, and I'll leave the party out of this, anytime I've actually talked issues to somebody who's libertarian, 95% of the time they're, oh, well, you know, we actually pretty strongly agree and or lean towards one party or another. And for the most part, where it's issues like the wars, foreign policy, whether it's health care or education, they tend to fall pretty strongly along party lines. But for the most part, when they start out, they're just uninformed. And libertarian kind of defaults to the view of, oh, well, I am on my own, everyone should be on their own, don't bother me. So once they become more informed, they tend to lean more towards one party or another.
Well, John, I appreciate the call to the show. Robert Draper, go ahead.
Yeah, sure. I mean, I think that there's a lot of truth to what John's saying insofar as, I mean, we've seen this before with people who are, you know, view themselves as conservatives and view themselves as resenting governments over taxation of them, the belief that the government hands out too many social services to other people. But when the poll questions have to do with, say, the role that Social Security plays in their life or Medicare, it becomes suddenly hands off my Medicare, hands off my Social Security. Sure, there's no question that that voters, when an issue becomes personalized, will view it differently than they do in the absence. Nonetheless, I do think that there are certain trend lines. I mean, it's to me, the data is pretty incontrovertible that over the last few years, decriminalization of marijuana and the advocacy of same-sex marriage are propositions that, as recently as 10 years ago, did not enjoy majorities in this country. They now do, and to some degree, that's liberalism, you know, classic liberalism, but also to a degree, it reflects the belief that we are wasting too many resources, for example, on the war on drugs, that has failed. It's not so much that everybody wants to smoke dope, though perhaps there are many who do, but also the belief that the war itself is a flawed notion, has not alleviated anything, has been a costly endeavor, not just in terms of economics, but in terms of the social consequences.
About a minute before a second break, we have a tweet from Rusty saying, how willing are libertarians to compromise their ideals in order to actually get something done? And I guess that's a question, if someone truly believes something, perhaps even beyond believing libertarian ideas, will they compromise?
Yeah, sure. And you know, that's why I was fascinated when I listened to Senator Rand Paul speak before a Rotary group at Shelbyville, Kentucky. And he made a point of saying, look, you know, government agencies can overstep their authority. But, for example, on the subject of pollution, I'm pro-coal. I'm from a pro-coal state. But we need to drastically reduce pollution. We have done so. And what's the reason for that? In a large part, it's due to government regulation. So I'm not against the very purest notion, and I've heard it from a lot of libertarian purists, was abolish the EPA. Rand Paul, who wants to get something done in the immediate, wants to get elected, is singing a different tune.
And that's Robert Draper, our guest in this hour of Radio Times, part of Ballot Talks, something we do now Thursdays on Radio Times. And he's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine. We're talking about his recent cover story, Has the Libertarian Moment Finally Arrived? And I do want to talk about the Tea Party, something that he wrote about a couple of years ago, a book out in paperback now called When the Tea Party Came to Town. We also want to hear from you about your view of libertarian politics, libertarian candidates and ideas. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can send us a tweet at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Chapin School, a pre-K through 8th grade independent school in Princeton, supports WHYY. With small classes and high academic expectations, Chapin students receive personal attention from a faculty dedicated to helping them succeed academically. Chapin's focus on the virtues of respect, responsibility, honesty, kindness, and perseverance seeks to nurture students with a strong moral fiber. Chapin students also demonstrate strong abilities in the arts, music, sports, and technology. More at chapinschool.org.
Great question. That is a great question.
And that's a great question.
Wow, that's another great question.
That's a great question.
Oh, that's a great that's a great question.
That is a great question.
What a great question.
On Fresh Air, you'll hear unexpected questions and unexpected answers.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
Islamic State gets the attention of the White House.
We will continue to confront this hateful terrorism and replace it with a sense of hope and civility. That's what Jim Foley stood for.
Considering a response to the execution on video of an American journalist, ISIS wants a war with America. Next time on The Takeaway from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Robert Draper, who says that the public's frustration with government surveillance and costly wars and the war on drugs, plus the growing support for gay marriage, could mean that the time is right for libertarian ideas, especially for the Republican Party. And again, that's what he writes about in his cover story of the New York Times Magazine earlier this month, titled, Has a Libertarian Moment Finally Arrived? And we have more calls coming in at 1-888-477-7-9-4-9-9. Before we get back to our callers, though, and I'm interested in how you then compare and contrast the Tea Party, which you wrote about a couple of years ago. I guess it was after the 2010 election when they won so many seats in Congress. How you compare them to the Libertarian Party such as it is?
Sure. I think it's a really interesting subject, Marty, because in 2009, I think that during the time that the Tea Party was really coalescing, there was a lot of commonality between libertarians and the Tea Party, which at its root was basically about TEA, tax enough already, and about high government spending. But since that time, the Tea Party has become something of a moving target. I should add, by the way, that in 2010, Rand Paul ran essentially as a libertarian Tea Partier, and later, you know, himself wrote a book called The Tea Party Comes to Washington. But since that time, the Tea Party has been animated by things that do not animate libertarians. By immigration, for example, by a real disdain of almost anything that has to do with Barack Obama. And that's not where libertarians play. And on top of which, the Tea Party has become kind of the purview of elderly, mostly white people. And so what you did see in 2009, 2010, and thereafter, where you saw it at Tea Party gatherings, young people, but they were Ron Paul people. And I think that there's now a split between the Tea Party and libertarians. They agree on a few things, but the degree to which the Tea Party is animated by, say, you know, immigration and border security, animated by their hate of Obama, sets them apart from libertarians.
I'm going to show my ignorance here. That's what the Tea Party stands for? Taxed enough already?
Yeah, that's how it began.
I'm embarrassed to say I did not know.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, and it was very much a don't tread on me, and you know, we need a more restrained government. This is a runaway government. The things like the stimulus bothered people. High taxes, but now it's become more of a bastion of social conservatism and of anti-immigration reform than it is those bedrock economic issues.
Let me get David from Allentown to join our conversation. Hi, David. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Good morning.
Good morning.
I just wanted to comment. I love everything you've been saying, Robert. It matches my experience perfectly. I'm 34, and when I started college out at Kutztown, there was a organization, you know, just a student club that I started spending time with there. I'm still affiliated with them. But now I'm old enough, older than the students that I've watched, like, the political attitudes change, and it was primarily a left-leaning group, and as time has gone by, I've watched it move much more towards libertarianism. They're all very socially liberal, but fiscally conservative, so it's been interesting to watch the conversations change over the years.
And does that describe you, David?
I don't know. I'm a registered Democrat. I certainly have libertarian ideas, but I think that's probably more so with the younger crowd.
I appreciate the call to Radio Times, which does raise the question, Robert Draper, whether, you know, people generally grow out of their libertarian ideas.
Well, I think what it is, Marty, is that the answer is yes, some of them do. But I think the more salient issue for them is that what do? Do they politically participate or do they not? It's widely viewed that voting for a third party, be it the Libertarian Party, the Socialist Party, does not amount to real participation insofar as your vote actually counting. So then who, you know, which of the two major parties most faithfully represents the things that are important to them, and particularly for young voters, that has tended to be the Democratic Party. But they have, you know, I don't think that we have yet seen, we've seen in midterm elections, I don't think we've seen it recently in presidential elections, that young voters stay home in droves because they're turned off by either party. They tend to express themselves. But that does not to suggest, and as some critics of my story have, that, oh, well, they may say they're libertarian, they may look like libertarian in polls, but in the end they vote Democrat. Well, they vote because they want to participate. That's why.
We have an email from Olive, and actually I want to piggyback off of her question. What role do you think libertarians play in regards to the increasing power of corporations? And she's probably thinking of the Koch brothers, who are, you know, the most perhaps famous libertarians in the country?
Absolutely, yes. And it's interesting. I mean, the Koch brothers are an interesting case in point because they helped found the Libertarian Party. One of the Koch brothers actually ran for vice president on the Libertarian Party ticket in, I believe, 1980. And they put a lot of money behind the LP. Since then, however, they've decided they want results and they want to win. And the things they want to win are, among other things, the drastic scaling back of regulations on businesses, and so they have cast their lot with Republicans. The real interesting question, Marty, is going to be in 2016, who wins the Koch brothers sweepstakes, whether it will be someone that they have faithfully put their money behind for years or whether it will be Rand Paul. They never put a lot of money behind Ron Paul. His two presidential runs as a Republican were not heavily funded at all by the Koch brothers. It remains to be seen whether they'll see Rand Paul not only as a guy who can win, but as a guy who can win espousing libertarian ideals.
And they have a lot of money that they can spend on the upcoming election.
Yes, they do.
Indeed. Let me get, looks like Michael from Fairmount to join us on Radio Times. Hi, Michael. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Maddie. Hi. I just wanted to make a statement that, you know, young voters, from what I've seen, you know, are kind of disenfranchised with Republican and Democrats. And the reason why, you know, we'll go to, you know, Tea Party or libertarianism or, you know, socialism is because we want a fresh voice. I mean, you can look at, you know, sound bites of any politician and, you know, it's almost like an abusive relationship. Like, they'll tell us anything we want, that they think we want to hear in order for us to keep them in power. You know, it's two sides of the same coin. You know, I look at, you know, Republicans and Democrats as, you know, the WWF. You know, you might have, you know, Hulk Hogan and Macho Man Randy Savage duking it out, but at the end of the day, they're at the bar having a beer together. You know, and to me, I look at, like, libertarianism as a fresh voice, or even anything as a fresh voice. I mean, you know, you look at the one libertarian candidate, N.A. Poe, that ran for city council, and, you know, he was kind of just a comedian. I really didn't take him seriously, but at the same time, he got on the ballot, and he got more than one vote. So, I mean,
you got more than one vote, you're saying. Well, let me ask you a quick question, Michael. So give me one issue, or give us one issue that you care deeply about. What is it?
I think what I care deeply about is education. I mean, to me, I see, you know, the depletion of education in society, especially in Pennsylvania. It's almost like a war on education. You know, I mean, we give tax breaks to build private prisons, and then we defund schools. And it's all you are is breeding ignorant people that are more likely to fill prisons.
All right. Well, Michael, I appreciate the call to Radio Times, and that is a very Philadelphia and Pennsylvania-centric response. But Robert Draper, I don't know what the libertarian response or solution to Pennsylvania's education problems are.
Well, it's what Michael, it sounds like what Michael is espousing was a concern most frequently voiced by progressives, who are concerned that the slashing of education funds in the name of fiscal stability or whatever comes at the expense of our public education system. It's again, libertarians are sort of all over the map. They'll talk about homeschooling. They'll talk about a less statist approach to they're almost united in their opposition, say, to Common Core. But so are conservatives, and even some liberals are. But there's something else I wanted to bring up. Sure. Just in listening to Michael talk, that when he said that basically he feels like a lot of young voters like him have been sold a bill of goods by the parties, and I have a lot of young Republican friends who have remain staunch conservatives on fiscal issues, but they have said to me, I just wish our party would never bring up the subject of gay marriage again. I wish our party would quit obsessing about border security. I wish our party would quit saying that. That marijuana is heinous. And essentially what they're saying is, look, it's not that we want to become liberals on those issues. We actually believe that there is a view of government restraint that should apply to these social issues. And what they are espousing, whether they realize it or not, is a kind of libertarian impulse, which is laissez-faire, leave us alone, and that should apply not just to the free market, but should apply as well to how individuals spend their own lives.
I mean, how does Reince Priebus think about that, or what does he think about that?
Reince Priebus wants to win, and we're referring to the chairman of the Republican National Committee, and I interviewed Priebus, who is very, very I think he's genuinely appreciative of Rand Paul. After all, Rand Paul, you could argue more than any other major political figure in the Republican Party, is doing his level best to grow the Republican Party's base by going out and speaking to on campuses, to African Americans, to Latino groups. Ted Cruz is not going into enemy territory the way Rand Paul is, and Priebus sees that as something that's a no-lose proposition. To that extent, then, he's highly supportive of Rand Paul.
We have a tweet, my libertarian friends can't offer one example of a functional libertarian society. Is there one? That's a question to you, Robert.
No, it's
a good
question.
You're not a libertarian, but
one reason why that's interesting is because there are different strands of libertarianism. I went to this in New Hampshire, Lancaster, New Hampshire. There's an annual outdoor libertarian event called Pork Fest, and the people named after the ubiquitous porcupine in that area, and the 1,700 who attended, they are largely what you would call anarcho-capitalists. They basically believe that government should be stripped down to near nothingness, and that people should have kind of communal values, that's where values take root, and that's where policing should take root. And that's a far, far cry from anything that we see, not only from either political party, but also from any modern day notion of what American governance should look like. And these are people who have essentially opted out of the American form of government. And so it's an interesting question to ask folks like that, but it's also an interesting question to ask guys like at the Cato Institute,
sure,
who have regularly put up votes for Libertarian Party candidates, and who put out tons and tons of position papers, but again largely to advance an idea here, an idea there, but never with an actual here's what Rand Paul should do when he becomes president.
Let me get Matt from West Philadelphia to join our conversation. Hi, Matt. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
So I voted a libertarian in the last election. I'm a millennial, and the primary reason I voted was for the legalization of recreational drugs. I'll take my answer.
Well, Matt, don't go away. Let me ask you a quick question. Right. Do you think, though, certainly looking at how, I don't know if you're talking about all drugs or just marijuana, when you see this happening in other states, do you see that as a result of libertarian politics, or do you just see government finally deciding to legalize something that you think that they should?
I think it's from the libertarian grassroots efforts and people behind the idea, not necessarily the government, the state government taking control over it, and the people that who are influencing the government action.
Well, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Robert Draper is saying it's because of libertarians that these states are now legalizing marijuana.
Well, yeah, and I'm not so sure that that's true. I mean, it, to some degree, it is just a liberalization, you know, of you know, social issues and the view as well that you know, marijuana now, marijuana has been in the mainstream for decades. You know, people have more or less, you know, the ability to get a sense of how deleterious a drug it is versus the social and economic costs of trying to keep marijuana out of the hands, particularly of youngsters. And I think the marijuana decriminalization issue is resonant among young voters. Okay, for some of them, they just want to smoke a lot of pot. But I think also it is because Republicans in particular have appeared to be the, you know, caretakers of outmoded thinking, of policing virtue. And young voters tend to reject that, you know, not just because they like marijuana, but because the very notion of government telling them how they should conduct their private affairs is one they recoil from. And that, again, is a classic libertarian point of view.
Matt, thanks for the call. I'm going to steal Julie's question. I see it on the computer here. Julie from West Mount Airy. She says, why are there so few women associated with the Libertarian Party? We began with that, but I think it's an important question, and it's actually something that you deal with in your piece as well.
Sure, and it's also something that is changing a little bit. I mean, it's, you know, it's an irony because Ayn Rand, of course, is, you know, one of the big the objectivist philosopher and novelist, was one of the big proponents of libertarianism. But she had a large following, almost all of them young white males, you know, typically of college age. And I think that this notion of that is not only, you know, a social permissiveness, and which I think a lot of women can adhere to as well as men, not only a restraint in terms of overseas contact, which I think also women can cleave to just as much as women as men, but the view that the marketplace, you know, should rule, that there should be market-based answers rather than government answers, can be discordant, particularly to single women who happen to be happen to have children and who see that, you know, the basic view being that look, you know, laissez-faire economic principles can take care of their lives. They cannot, or at least market-based solutions are not always ones that are directly applicable to their experience. And so I think that but having said all that, there are much more women libertarians. I can't quantify it, but anecdotally that seems clearly the case now in 2014 than there were, say, 20 years ago.
Well, on that note, Robert Draper, thank you so much for joining us in this hour of Ballot Talks on Radio Times. Thanks so much.
It's my pleasure, Marty.
You're welcome. And he's a contributing writer to the New York Times Magazine, and we've been talking about a piece he wrote earlier this month titled, Has a Libertarian Moment Finally Arrived? And again, wrote a book about the Tea Party called When the Tea Party Came to Town, now out in paperback. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times, and you can download a podcast of the show. You can also check us out on Facebook and Twitter. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times, and do stay with us. We'll be right back.